Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power, and we shine light ahead of us where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together. In other words, to address problems instead of just defending positions. Well, the world as we know it is brought to a screeching halt by a deadly novel coronavirus. And the entire world, doctors and scientists, world leaders and ordinary people, work as one to share the best information as rapidly as possible so we can face this challenge as one united, purposeful species. Well, not quite. Not quite. Maybe in some parallel universe. Well, you know, for a brief moment, there was a recognition that for the first time, all of humanity faced one common challenge, and that we had the worldwide communication network to find the best practices and adopt them as quickly as possible. But then reality set in, the reality of economic and political interests pushing their agendas and seeking to discredit, deplatform other points of view. On one hand, we have a president who has lied so consistently that even when he makes a truthful statement, he has no credibility. On the other hand, we have a medical industrial complex claiming to represent science, when in actuality, it more often represents the science that just supports its own financial interests. Add to this a polarized population skeptical of anything the other side has to say, and the stage is set for disaster. A nation shut down and economically paralyzed without the benefit of defeating the virus to actually show for it. We have truly, new word, a situation. Well, this week on Wiki Politiki, we're going to interview Dr. Meryl Nass, internist and biological warfare epidemiologist, to help us get past the political narratives to find a likelier story of how COVID-19 took hold, where we are today, and what treatments are likely to make a difference. Dr. Meryl Nass, MD, ABIM, is an internist with special interests in vaccine-induced illness, chronic fatigue syndrome, Gulf War illness, fibromyalgia, and toxicology. As a biological warfare epidemiologist, she investigated the world's largest anthrax epizootic in Zimbabwe, and she developed a model for analyzing epidemics to assess whether they are natural or man-made. She's also an expert on Gulf War syndrome and its relationship to the anthrax vaccine that was given to troops. She's played a major role in creation of a coalition that's fought the anthrax vaccine immunization program. She is active in assisting legal teams defending anthrax vaccine refusers and ill service members in the U.S. and Canada. Today, we're going to mainly be talking about COVID-19. Welcome, Dr. Nass.
Thank you very much for having me.
Good. Okay. Well, before we talk about COVID-19, the likeliest story and the best responses, let's get a bit of background because I'm always interested in how people find their work and their calling. You're an MD who's become an expert on Gulf War illness, anthrax, and the anthrax vaccine. How did all this come about?
I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. which was a Positions for Social Responsibility meeting. And students, along with the wife of one of the members, had brought up the fact that researchers at the University of Massachusetts, this was right near the University of Massachusetts, were doing germ warfare research, so-called. And they had unearthed this as part of a course. And I was an instructor at the UMass Med School and attended the meeting and didn't think it was likely and said I would read the curriculum vitae, the resume of the professor that they were accusing, and see what it said and look at his publications. And when I did that, I discovered that, in fact, his grants were titled that they were with words indicating they were looking for a better anthrax vaccine, but in fact they had nothing to do with vaccine research and were looking for ways of preparing new strains of anthrax. So it was a sort of a primitive genetic engineering of anthrax, possibly for increased virulence. And so I was very concerned. This was being done at UMass with government contracts from the U.S. Biodefense Center at Fort Detrick. And so I started looking further into the subject and wound up becoming an expert shortly before the Gulf War occurred. And then, of course, there was a call for people who knew about anthrax. And in the process, I also decided to look at the last 15 years of anthrax epidemics, or epizootic means it spreads from animals, that humans get it through an animal source. Mm-hmm. Rather than an epidemic where we get it from each other, we catch it from each other. And it turned out that one of those epidemics looked unnatural, and I explored it for 3 years and was able to show that it was as a result of biological warfare.
Wow. So were you kind of an outlier at that point? I mean, it seemed like you were skeptical yourself that this was going on. All of a sudden, you find out that indeed these things are being weaponized. So that must have put you a little bit outside of the mainstream conversation.
Yes, right. When I started this, I was a young doctor in my 30s, and now I'm 69. So I was very much outside the mainstream, and I guess continued to explore it because there were calls. You know, there were lots of interviews with someone who knew anything about anthrax at the time of the Gulf War. And then soldiers were given mandated anthrax vaccines in the military. Every soldier, sailor, airman, Coast Guard person had to be vaccinated, including even non-soldiers who were carrying goods for the military. So that if you were a merchant marine on certain ships, you were required to be vaccinated. And the vaccine was very old. It had been developed originally in the 1950s, but the lots were old. They had expired several times and had been redated, which is not legal, and most of them had never passed the proper tests. And the FDA had kind of looked the other way. They had not inspected the plant in many years and had left it to the Army to do the inspections, which also is not in accordance with the law. And so once soldiers started getting vaccinated, a lot of them got sick, and they were able to find me on the internet and contact me. And when probably the first 50 stories were told to me about people getting sick from the vaccine, you know, I said vaccines don't do that. And finally, enough people by this time it has been several thousand. I realized that the anthrax vaccine was uniquely bad, although it caused a lot of syndromes or symptoms that can be caused by other vaccines, but at a much higher rate, with up to 1 to 2% becoming in those days with that old vaccine. It's a little better now, becoming permanently disabled. And some dying. And this is from a report that the CDC and the Government Accountability Office wrote. So it was a very bad vaccine. And I sort of fell into it and became a key person in a coalition of military officers and others who fought the vaccine, fought the mandatory nature of this vaccine only in the military. And we were able to take this to court and have a judge remove the license of the vaccine and tell FDA they needed to completely redo the license. But unfortunately, FDA decided to just rubber stamp it. And 2 years later, the military began using it again. But they were no longer using the really expired lots. So they had newer vaccine, and it probably was not as dangerous as before.
What was dangerous in the vaccine other than the fact that it was expired and perhaps ineffective?
Since the government, you know, to this day denies that there's anything wrong with the vaccine, and since the military owns all of the samples, I can't tell you what molecules in the vaccine were causing problems. What I can tell you is it's a dirty vaccine. So it's not, most vaccines today are fairly pure. They're cleaned up to have a certain, certain number of antigens and not much else. But in this vaccine, that was never done. They basically grew anthrax in a fermenter and then spun the material down, and whatever went to the bottom of the centrifuge was then resuspended or re-put into solution and became the vaccine after all the anthrax was killed. So it contained a lot of different material, a lot of RNA, DNA, proteins, carbohydrates, anything you can think of that occurs when anthrax grows. And anthrax, as you know, kills people. It's a very virulent bacteria. So one or more of those products, or maybe the amount of them and the combination of them together, wound up causing all sorts of problems. In addition, because the lots were made under substandard conditions, some of the lots had visible bacterial growth and fungal growth in them. Some had visible particulates from the rubber stoppers, and yet some of these lots were used in people. So there were a lot of problems, and I can't pin it down to one thing.
And somehow this was also linked with Gulf War illness. Is that right?
So it has been linked in some studies, certainly not all, and the government denies it. Government really denies that anything causes Gulf War syndrome except for psychological problems in the veterans. But there have been a number of studies that showed the more doses of all, so many vaccines were given to soldiers at the time of the Gulf War. These were U.S. soldiers and soldiers from other countries. And so our troops were not the only ones who developed illnesses. And they were also exposed to a lot of other toxic materials, like things to prevent bugs. They used tent heaters, which were burning diesel fuel or other fuels and were not vented when they slept. Some people were drinking water that had come from tanks that had held gasoline or diesel fuel and had not been cleaned. They were burning a lot of materials and breathing in the fumes from that. So there were a lot of oil fire fumes going on in Iraq. So there were, some people were wearing flea collars because of the bugs. So I had many, many exposures, but there are some studies that show that if you got the anthrax vaccine, you are more likely to get Gulf War syndrome. But you certainly did not need anthrax vaccine to develop a chronic illness characterized by fatigue, pain, and usually cognitive impairment afterwards, which is also how chronic fatigue syndrome is defined.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like certainly is an indicator that the people who serve us in the military are expendable. And, you know, there's so many different ways, so many different toxins that they're exposed to. It's hard to tell which is which. On a different subject, you studied the 2009 swine flu pandemic and warned against the use of novel vaccine adjuvants, which may be used in a COVID vaccine. I'm not sure what the term adjuvant means. What are these adjuvants and how might they cause harm?
Well, let me just drop back to the last thing we were saying, because I want to add the fact I'm very interested in incentives and disincentives to behavior, particularly by governments or industries.
Yes.
In the case of the military, if their soldiers become ill and have to be pensioned off, the VA is a different federal agency budget that's responsible for taking care of them. So the Department of Defense can just, you know, fire them when they get sick. And it, and in most, in the vast majority of cases, the Defense Department itself does not wind up paying a pension to those people. So there is not enough of a disincentive for them to stop exposing soldiers to toxic materials. Now, getting back to adjuvants, so adjuvants are, it's a long word. In the vaccine field, it means something that stimulates the immune system non-specifically. In other words, no matter what antigen we give you, no matter what thing we want you to respond to, if we add an adjuvant, you will have a stronger response to that product, a stronger immune response. Now, the classic adjuvant that is present in almost all of the killed vaccines that don't contain a live, weakened microbe, is aluminum. And there are different forms, there's two or three different forms of aluminum that can be used. And that is that we have a high dose of aluminum in the anthrax vaccine and aluminum in many other vaccines. But aluminum is not strong enough to stimulate the immune response required to provide adequate immunity for many illnesses. So stronger adjuvants have been investigated over many decades. And they have been used only in some animal vaccines. And then in a very few vaccines, such as those used in people with complete kidney failure or the elderly who have weakened immune systems. And it was felt that these highly stimulating adjuvants would be safe in those populations. And probably they are, although I'm not certain of that. There has not been enough published research on that subject. But over the last 10 or 15 years, a few vaccines slowly have had novel adjuvants used, some of which contain squalene, some contain other products. And as I say, they brought them in to limited populations. But over the last 5 years, some of these adjuvants have been added to vaccines in other populations. So in Canada, a vaccine that is used in babies aged 6 months to 2 years for the flu, one of several that is available in Canada, contains a novel adjuvant. It's called Fluad. And, you know, most Canadians have no idea. They just take their child, the baby, in to be vaccinated, and they don't know what they're getting. And they probably, neither they nor their doctor, has any idea whether it's causing any adverse reactions.
We're going to have to take a very short break, and we'll be back and talk more about the adjuvants and COVID-19 when we get back with Dr. Meryl Nass. This is Steve Behrman, WikiPoliticky.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Tat.
Times Radio, IOM FM. OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on OM Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
A social distancing tip.
While the CDC urges you to avoid close contact, like hugging or shaking hands, there are other non-physical ways to say hello. Wave, wink, use sign language, salute, smile, give the peace sign, throw up an air high five, do jazz hands. Remember, stay a minimum of 6 feet or 2 arms length away from others, and stay home if you can. For more info, visit coronavirus.gov.
Let's all do our part, because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Okay, we're back with Dr. Merrill Nass. I want to pick up on that, on the adjuvant, and make a comment. I've always thought that aluminum is a toxin, and it's been associated with Alzheimer's and that sort of thing. Is the aluminum as an adjuvant, is that in a large enough portion to actually do harm?
Well, these are good questions. The problem is that industry has been able to buy enough science to obfuscate the answers. So is anyone warning you, for example, not to wrap your food in aluminum foil? The anthrax vaccine has, I think, 0.6 milligrams per dose, and you have to get 5 doses for the initial course. So that is 3 milligrams per person. It seems like a lot.
You suggested that while there have been studies that point to possible toxicity, they've been obfuscated. Say a little bit more about that. I think that's something of great concern. There are people who say, well, you know, we should follow the science, right? And science, yes, says that there's no harm to that. How do we determine? How did you determine that there have been studies that have been, as you say, obfuscated?
Well, I'm most familiar with the vaccine literature, and that is designed to look for problems with vaccines. You know, vaccines are a sacred cow in the United States. So even if you do the research yourself, if you self-fund it, for example, or you get some philanthropists to fund it, what has happened there? I know of a couple of philanthropists who have been called out in major media in the United States, had their names plastered in the New Yorker or other, you know, large magazines, and disgraced basically because they gave money to an anti-vaxxer researcher. There's a researcher who's probably the best one in the world on the toxicity of aluminum, and he has lost all his funding. And I think Robert F. Kennedy gave him some funding out of his personal funds, and his university in England would not allow him to accept it. So this is done at the university level, at the level of the medical journals, which they can't survive without pharmaceutical ads and pharmaceutical reprints. So you can't get these articles into journals. You can't get them funded. Your researchers are being hounded. And yet the pharmaceutical companies can do studies. They can ghostwrite them. Ghostwriting means, let's say they do this is a typical thing that is done in the pharmaceutical industry. They will have, they will set up a study and they will design it. And it will be done at five different centers. And the investigators at each center have to sign an agreement that they have no access to the totality of the data. So only the pharmaceutical company knows what the results were from all of those five centers. Then they pay a medical education company to write up the report of the study in the way they want done. And then they work with this company, and then they or the medical education company gets this into a top journal by agreeing to buy some large number of reprints. And unfortunately, you know, this is the way basically it works. And the editors of The Lancet, the current editor of The Lancet, former editors of the New England Journal and of the British Medical Journal have all said this, that basically pharma has made its way into every part of the medical industry and taken it over.
I'm looking at a quote here from Marcia Angell, who is the editor of New England Journal of Medicine. The quote is, quote, "It is simply no longer possible to believe much of the clinical research that is published or to rely on the judgment of trusted physicians or authoritative medical guidelines. I take no pleasure in this conclusion, which I reached slowly and reluctantly over my two decades as editor of the New England Journal of Medicine." So there you have it. I mean, here is somebody who was in authority, one of the mediators of information, supposedly, and she's confirming that. Here's another quote. "Over the past two decades," she says, "the pharmaceutical industry has moved very far from its original high purpose of discovering and producing useful new drugs, now primarily a marketing machine to sell drugs of dubious benefit. This industry uses its wealth and power to co-opt every institution that might stand in its way, including the U.S. Congress, the FDA, academic medical centers, and the medical profession itself," unquote. So seems like there's a certain degree of agreement here. And yet, if you mention Robert F. Kennedy Jr., there's always an epithet of the discredited conspiracy theorist and so on. And these are the kinds of labels that are used so consistently that one would imagine that we're reading Pravda and not the American media. I think that this is something that's definitely worth underlining. And now let's talk about another controversial narrative. President Trump's been attacked and ridiculed for advocating hydroxychloroquine as a treatment for COVID because it's said to cause heart damage. What you've been studying this issue as well. Can you clear the air about this drug? And what do we know about it?
I'll also just refer people to my blog, which is anthraxvaccine.blogspot.com, where I have a long article, 36 reasons, 36 examples of the fraud that has been perpetrated regarding hydroxychloroquine and other measures related to the pandemic. So it's an important article. It's gotten more hits than anything else I've ever written on the blog in 13 years. The hydroxychloroquine, and I'm very familiar with the drug. I took its cousin chloroquine myself for about 8 to 10 months when I was in malarial areas, and I overdosed myself on it when I later got malaria. That was, you know, my own doing, and it's quite a safe drug. It was at one point added to table salt in countries that have a lot of malaria. Hydroxychloroquine was developed as a slightly safer version and became very popular for rheumatoid arthritis and then lupus. And it is usually the first drug that is given to a lupus patient when they're diagnosed, apart from maybe aspirin. So something like 7 million prescriptions were written for hydroxychloroquine in 2017 in the U.S. And billions of prescriptions, probably, or doses have been given around the world because there are, you know, at least 1 or 2 billion people who are possibly at risk of malaria. So These two drugs, which are almost the same drug, have been used for about 80 years. And before they were used, they were derived from quinine, which is derived from the bark of a tree. So that was used for hundreds of years. Although these two drugs have a potential side effect of widening the QT interval on an EKG and potentially causing an arrhythmia, this same side effect is also present in probably 100 other drugs that are commonly used. And it's extremely rare for this to happen. I have used the drug myself in probably between 100 and 200 patients over the last 20 years, because I use it a lot for Lyme disease, but I do have patients with rheumatoid arthritis and lupus who take it. And no, I have had one patient who had a side effect. She had received the drug from somebody else and had been on it for a very prolonged period. And she was a thin woman, and I think that the dose was too much for her. And I took her off the drug, and it has a very long half-life. And over a period of months, she had developed muscle weakness, and her muscle strength came back, which is what should happen if the drug was causing it. It has a very long half-life of perhaps a month and a half. So it builds up in the body. If you only take it for a week or 2 weeks at the most, the likelihood of you having a problem is almost nil. If you take it with azithromycin, which is how I've used it most of the time for Lyme, and that's how it is commonly used, but it can be used with doxycycline also and zinc for COVID, the risk of this arrhythmia increases because the azithromycin can also cause that side effect. As I said, at least 100 drugs can. But again, it has not been a problem. None of my patients have come in complaining of palpitations or have had heart arrhythmia problems clinically. Today, it has become such a big issue because people want to suppress the use of this drug that even my own patients are scared to take it now. But the data indicates that it's effective. We don't know how effective. It's probably between 50 and 90% effective early in COVID cases, and in late COVID cases, probably about 50% effective at saving people's lives from COVID.
How does it act on COVID? How does the drug, what does the drug do?
Well, with a lot of drugs, we don't really know how they work. And that's very strange. And with other drugs, FDA does not require the manufacturer to tell you on the label because that information is proprietary.
Right.
That being said, this drug has two well-known mechanisms of action that would be good. It does kill virus. So if you take this drug when you have an early case of COVID, the viral counts in your throat and in your lungs will go down rapidly. So it's antiviral. We don't usually think of an antimalarial, an antiparasitic drug as being antiviral. Turns out a number of them are. It also is an immune modulator. That's why it's used in lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. So if you get into the late stage of COVID, when your immune system is unregulated and overactive, it might be helpful then too.
Interesting. Now, I mean, this is going to sound like a silly question, but I think it's a very important question, and that is, who is repressing this and why, and how is it being allowed, how is that repression being allowed to continue?
Well, the most likely entity that would be suppressing this drug is the entity that owns its competitor. Its competitor is remdesivir, and a pharmaceutical company named Gilead owns that drug. That drug, including two of the three co-chairs, one of whom was the deputy director of NIAID. So he was the assistant or the deputy director to Fauci at NIAID, Cliff Lane.
Wow. Well, we're going to take another break, and we'll be back with Dr. Nass and talk a little bit more about other aspects of COVID. This is Steve Behrman on WikiPolitiki. We'll be back shortly.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay. 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Okay, we're back on WikiPolitiki. We're talking with Dr. Meryl Nass. We've been talking about hydroxychloroquine and why it's been repressed. Remdesivir, the other. The drug that costs $3,000 plus per dose. So obviously money is an issue. Something else that I want to touch on. You've also expressed the view, and tell me if I'm mistaken, that COVID-19 originated in a laboratory. What evidence do you have for this, if that's your view? And tell me about that theory.
This is a very complicated theory that many people hold around the world. Basically, if you look at the literature on bat coronaviruses over the past 15 to 20 years, which really expanded after SARS, the first SARS, which occurred in 2002 and was mainly in China, but also in Southeast Asia, and there were a number of cases in Canada, had a 9 to 10% mortality rate. It scared the living daylights out of everyone. And also, SARS, it's not clear where that came from. They have not found the progenitor virus in nature. But in any event, the research expanded and found ways to make bat coronaviruses more virulent. And this particular coronavirus includes some of the discoveries that have been made over the last few years in different countries. And these countries have shared information, they've shared scientists, they have funded each other, and that's a lot of different countries. So it includes the European Union, Japan, China, Singapore, Australia, United States, etc., have all been very invested, including Fauci's NIAID, which spent up to $51 million in a single year on coronavirus research. Even though he doesn't seem to know anything about coronaviruses, his institute has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on coronavirus research, And some of this has been defined as gain of function, when that is a euphemism for making the bug more virulent. So anyway, when you review that, all this literature, you can see that there has not been a coronavirus with these particular facets before. And this particular coronavirus still has a lot of genetic material that has yet to be explored and explained. So virologists are working very aggressively on it, but it has changes in the way it binds to human cells, and it has something called a furin cleavage site, which is unusual, that allows it to enter more kinds of human cells. And it has created a relatively unique syndrome, although very similar to the SARS-1 syndrome. So for reasons that I can't really explain any better than that, because it would cause me to go too deeply into the fine genetic details, there are good reasons to think it was created in the lab and that the knowledge of how to create it already existed in the published literature.
You know, there's been some connection, of course, with Fauci and a lab in Wuhan, China, that's been called some kind of a, you know, conspiracy theory. Is there any indication that Dr. Fauci was working on, I would call it weaponizing, the gain of function is a euphemism, as you said, of weaponizing these bugs for use in germ warfare?
What I can say is that in 2014, after there were leaks, there were very bad leaks exposed at Dugway Proving Ground and the CDC, where people were exposed to anthrax, bird flu, Ebola. There was also some smallpox and other things found at FDA and at NIH that weren't accounted for. There was imposed by the federal government a ban on certain gain-of-function experiments, and there was a call to look at these, and there were a lot of meetings and papers published and blah, blah, blah. Seven, I believe, experiments were allowed that were gain-of-function experiments. And it was three viruses for which this kind of research was temporarily banned. And it was coronavirus, interestingly, bird flu, and I think influenza. I might have that last one wrong. In 2017, the NIH decided to remove the ban and allow so-called gain-of-function research to proceed. Fauci was in favor of not having that ban. Both Fauci, and who is head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, and the head of the entire NIH, who is currently Francis Collins, both were against the board and which ones would be prevented. But they were not going to make public, their deliberations, and the public was not going to find out what kind of research was being allowed. So, although Fauci's NIAID did partially fund the Wuhan lab where the bat coronavirus research was going on. So there were at least two grants that over a period of at least 6 years that partially funded them. Some of that money went through an interesting sort of shady pass-through organization called the Eco Health Alliance. That sounds very crunchy granola, but actually transferred a lot of money from the Defense Department, the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, to other countries to trap bats and to do research on viruses. And this is a very curious thing that nobody outside the inner sanctum understands. Why are all these countries funding each other to do what back and forth? There is no explanation. Fauci certainly has not offered any comment at all about this. But I think the public should be very concerned at what is going on. Why are all these countries helping and funding each other to develop more virulent microorganisms, particularly coronaviruses?
Now, here's a question. Is there any benefit to doing this gain-of-function research and work other than to weaponize these germs?
Well, of course, the justification for this research is that it will help us to anticipate what organisms we may encounter and produce vaccines and drugs as countermeasures. But in fact, all of this...
We can see that, there is this wall of secrecy that most people in this country are going along with because they don't want to not believe the mainstream media, and they don't want to believe that those who are collectively in charge of our health may not have our best interests at heart. Finally, I want to get to this one thing, and there's many more things I could ask you, but in the present day reality right now, what protocols would you recommend for prevention and early stage and then later stage treatment for those people who have COVID? I don't know if you've had any patients who've developed this syndrome, but I'm just curious as to, given all that you've said and all that you know, how you would approach this on a practical level now.
Okay. The way I'm approaching it for myself is I am taking zinc every day. I'm taking 50 milligrams. I'm taking vitamin C. I'm making sure to have a good middle-of-the-road vitamin D level. So I'm taking about 4,000 units of vitamin D3 a day. And I happen to be taking something called N-acetylcysteine, or NAC, which helps increase the amount of glutathione. Some of these are theoretically useful, but they are not harmful. They're all good for you. And vitamin D and zinc have been shown to be effective in some other respiratory infections. And it seems that zinc kills coronavirus, and it has been used in conjunction with hydroxychloroquine with what is said to be better results by a number of doctors. So the literature, now, the public literature is limited, but that is what I do, and that is what I think is best. Now, homeopaths have developed some treatments. Chinese medicine doctors have developed treatments or preventives, and I certainly don't want to exclude them. I just don't know about them. Hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine is being used in India and in some countries as a prophylactic or preventive to COVID, and again, many people, India says it's conducted 3 trials and that it works, and they are giving it to all their frontline physicians, first responders, and police in India. You don't need much. You only need 1 or 2 pills a week as prophylaxis. So
wow.
You don't have to worry about the heart problem or any of the other. It seems very reasonable. I'm not doing it myself because I don't want to use up the supply, because I think it's definitely helpful, especially early in the illness. If you can treat early, I have only treated one person who was my son when he got it, and he was very sick for a few days, and then he immediately got over it, and by 6-7 days, he was 100% better, and he has been fine. He has had no recurrence of it at all.
And this is with hydroxychloroquine at that point?
With hydroxychloroquine, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, so it is legal to prescribe this. It's not illegal to prescribe.
Yeah, that's a whole nother funny issue. So doctors in the United States can prescribe any licensed drug. Now, most of the drugs we prescribe, 80%, are for an indication. An indication is a reason to prescribe that is on the label. In other words, the manufacturer went to FDA, provided evidence, and said, this is the reason we want to use this drug, and FDA approved it. 20% of the prescriptions written in the United States are for reasons or indications that are not on the drug's label, that the manufacturer did not ask FDA to approve the drug for, but it turned out it worked for that condition. For example, hydroxychloroquine was developed as an antimalarial, but it turned out it worked for rheumatoid arthritis. It also works for Lyme disease, and that's been shown in clinical trials. But Lyme disease, you know, is not on the label of hydroxychloroquine, but we can still use it. And so, legally, I can use it for COVID. But a very unique thing that I've never seen in 40 years of practicing medicine that has happened this year is that different actions at both the federal and state level have attempted to restrict the prescribing of this drug. So governors have ordered executive orders to limit it to either only hospitalized patients or to nobody or to only clinical trials. The pharmacy boards in some states have limited it. The actual pharmacy brands, so the CVS Pharmacy has said they won't issue the drug for COVID. The FDA did some very deliberately confusing things when it issued an emergency use authorization for the drug and then rescinded it in the beginning of June, I believe. They did not explain what an emergency use authorization was, and almost nobody knows. The only reason I know is because one was issued for anthrax vaccine. So I've actually read the law. The emergency use authorization allows the system to give out a drug that has not been approved by the FDA. Either it hasn't been, in the case of the hydroxychloroquine that was donated to the National Strategic Stockpile by six pharmaceutical companies, some of it was already expired. Some of it was manufactured in Pakistan in such a way that the FDA would never approve it. That was the chloroquine. And some of it is probably perfectly good drug. But the emergency use authorization allows it all to be used, despite the fact that some of it could not pass FDA approval, and takes away all liability from the manufacturer in that use.
Okay, wow. We have so much more to talk about. Dr. Meryl Ness, thank you so much for clearing the air on many, many issues. And thank you for your clarity and work. And this is Steve Behrman on WikiPolitiki. By the way, we on our WikiPolitiki page, we have a link to Dr. Ness's blog post. And I think this is a source of ongoing information and education. Again, thank you so much for being our guest on WikiPolitiki. We're back again next week.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.